My castaway this week is a writer, traveller and philosopher. His crowded life has experienced many episodes, a childhood in South Africa, a period as a member of the Bloomsbury set, several years as a Japanese prisoner of war, and after all that, another life almost as a writer, filmmaker and advisor to a prince and a prime minister. Now almost 90, he's revered as one of the great spirits of our age, a man whose wisdom and experience, as well as his belief in the therapy of wilderness and solitude, make him a commanding and respected figure. He is Sir Lawrence van der Post. I have this image of you, Sir Lawrence, as a small boy, because I know that you were a dreamer, Joseph the Dreamer, they called you, sitting in your mulberry tree, dreaming. What did you dream about? Did you dream that you were going to do wonderful things in your life, or were they idle dreams?
I don't think dreams ever were idle. In my mulberry tree, I spent reading and thinking there, but I had already been launched in the direction of listening to stories and telling stories and having a feeling that the whole of life was a story.
What kinds of stories?
Well, the first ones that lodged deeply with me I heard from my nurse. She was the first and most important people in my life. She was one of the few surviving authentic bushmen, that is, first people of Africa, one of the oldest races in the world, which has been cruelly made extinct. And she launched me in that direction of stories.
But you read classic boys' own stories as well, did you?
Yes. I mean,
you had a sense of adventure even then.
Well, the very first book I read was a book called The Coral Island, which has been a great book in my life because it's a story of three young people cast away on a coral island in the Pacific, perhaps a desert island we're concerned with today.
But did you dream then, when you read those books, did you dream of being an adventurer yourself?
No. I certainly didn't plan it.
But you did resolve, didn't you, when you were really very small, a very small boy, that you were going to rediscover the bushman?
Yes, that came from Clara, from my nurse. I felt very concerned about the bushman. And when I heard there were still some of them left intact in the Kalahari Desert, I said, one day when I'm grown up, I'm going to go to them and beg their pardon for what we've done to them in the past.
Because your forefathers had killed them?
Yes, my grandfather, in fact, had led one of the raids which exterminated the last of the Bushman people, simply because he said they wouldn't tame. They were always killing his cattle, he said. Well, cattle to them were just animals, and from the beginning of time, they had a right to kill animals for food.
And how old were you when you resolved to go out and apologise to them one day?
It happened just after the First World War broke, 1914. I was just getting on for 8.
And how old were you when you eventually found them and apologised?
And not until long after the war. I felt terribly ashamed of myself. It took so long.
Tell me about your first record that you'd like to take to this desert island of ours.
Well, could I begin with a Bushman one? It's a Bushman's song of women sitting as they sit in the huts in the evening, waiting for the hunters to come back. I call it the grass song.
Bushman of the Kalahari and the Song of the Rain. You say that your grandfather, Sir Lawrence, was responsible for organising the raid which exterminated, really, I think was the word that was used, the last of the Bushmen in the Orange Free State, or the Orange River Colony, I think,
as it was
called then. But not quite, was it? Because didn't he bring back two of them with him?
He heard some singing, some crying after the bushmen were killed. And he found two little bushmen, young bushmen, which he brought back, and they grew up in his home. And when I was a boy, they were little old men with grey hair. They were very great pals with my nurse, because they formed a little community.
What did they look like? I mean, describe the bushman to me.
They were only about 5 foot in height. They tended to be, when they were well fed, for the tummies to stick out, but they had this extraordinary behinds. It's a behind in which, in a good season, accumulated fats. It's rather like a hump to a camel. It stuck out behind. And my old grandfather used to say that in his day, they could stick out so far behind that you could stand a bottle of brandy on it. I don't know why a bottle of brandy.
And they're quite small.
Quite small. That was so endearing to me as a child, because they weren't dwarfs. They were beautifully formed, beautifully shaped.
And what about facially?
Oh, lovely faces. They had something Mongolian about the eyes. In fact, the early Dutch called them the Chinese-looking people.
And they were very gentle people, and they were your friends.
Yes, very gentle people. The whole history is one of gentleness.
And they taught you about their culture. They told you about their history,
yes,
did they?
Yes, of course, yes. They told me a lot from their point of view, about their stories and history.
And this, I suppose, would have been very important to you because you were one of, I think, 15 children, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I was number 13.
So you needed somebody else to talk to. Presumably your mother didn't have a lot of time to spend.
And also my father was rather an important public person, and my mother had to accompany him, and she was away a great deal. So in a sense, you see, it's interesting that I remember Clara. Really, before I remember my mother visually. I remember, first of all, the necklace that she always wore. I'd see the necklace first, and then a lovely sort of apricot skin, and then a face, beautiful face forming above it, but an ancient face.
And how old were you when she died?
When Tara died, I was about 12.
And the two little bushmen died?
They died first. One died of pneumonia. It was used to be a great killer in my part of Africa. And the other one died soon after of a broken heart and loneliness. People gone, and now his best friend gone.
So as far as you were concerned, by that stage, as I say, when you were still a small boy, that was the end of the Bushman?
That was the end of the Bushman, yes.
When did you discover, then, that he might still be out there somewhere?
It was the time just after my father had died. There were always great hunters and pioneers calling in on our home. And I remember a great white hunter came in the house and was telling that he had recently come from the Kalahari, and he was amazed to find, on the fringes even of the Kalahari, the Bushmen, as they were in our history.
So that was when you really knew you then could fulfil your ambition.
That's when I decided, yes.
And indeed, as time went on, eventually you made a BBC documentary about them. You wrote a book, The Lost World of the Kalahari, and you taught the world about the little Bushmen. But a lot was to happen in your life before then, which I want to talk to you about. So let's just pause there and have your second record. Tell me about that.
Well, this Japanese music was very important because it was the first country I went to outside Africa. And I travelled in a Japanese tramp ship. And at night, I used to lie on the deck in the tropics, looking at the mast, staring along at the star, and then unfailingly, the principal shakuhachi player among the crew would play this wonderful, eternal bamboo of the Far East.
Goro Yamaguchi playing Yugure no Kayoku on the shakuhachi flute. Japan, Sir Lawrence Vanderpost, has played a large part in your life. You went there, you learned its language and its culture. That was in the 20s, many years before you were to end up being starved and beaten as a prisoner of war. But was there a connection for you there, do you think? Do you think, in a sense, when you were asked to fight in Java, you'd always been prepared for that moment?
Yes, it's extraordinary. I found myself summoned by Wavell to join him in Java.
General Wavell?
General Wavell. Just after Pearl Harbor it happened, I went. I felt quite weird at the sense of calling. It's an experience I always thought of as being a sort of fairy tale experience, going to Japan. It wouldn't come into my life again. Suddenly, uncannily, it was in position. And what was more, I was to find in the jungles of Bantam that by buying two cups of coffee for a Japanese in 1926 in a restaurant where it had been thrown out because the woman said she couldn't have colored people in there, and I interfered and asked them to come and have coffee and waffles with me, I was saving my life in the jungles in 1942.
Were you?
Yes, indeed, because I was coming down a mountain when I walked into a Japanese trap, and from all sides the Japanese came with their bayonets at me. I'd forgotten a lot of my Japanese, but certainly the highest degree of politeness in Japan came back to me, and I called out as loudly as I could, "Would your gentleman please be so kind as to condescend as to wait an honourable moment?" And they were expecting to be shot at and fired at, but not the highest degrees of politeness. It was better than a bomb.
So it did the trick.
Yes, they stopped. They got
many people, of course, will have read your book about your experiences in the Japanese prisoner of war camp, and others will have seen the film version, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, with Tom Conti and David Bowie. It did seem, as represented there, that your understanding of the Japanese culture, as in the story you've just told, helped diffuse all sorts of difficult, potentially very dangerous situations.
Well, of course, my Japanese came back to me in prison. And I think the people in the camp, we were able to do things, I think, in a way, really, which was creative.
You did see a tremendous amount of terrible
violence. Oh, yes.
Death by all manner and means,
I think.
Harakiri included. What effect does that have on a man to witness such horrors with regularity?
I had a period when I was technically condemned to death, and where they took me out to see other people die. And I found that what was very important for our officers, when we were taken out to witness this, that you must not look away from the people who are being killed. For instance, one had his head cut off and the other was bound between trees, and they treated him for bayonet practice. And there was one officer between me and my fellow commanding officer, a wonderful RAF officer called Nichols. We both simultaneously put our hand round him because he was about to faint and said, "Look, Ori, look, look." And we felt that we must go through, otherwise the death would be pointless. And one got a certain strength from that. And everybody rallied. And I think it communicated itself to the Japanese, because on one occasion when they'd done this, the Japanese officer in charge came to me and he said, "Now I will show you Japanese respect for the dead." And they actually sounded bugle songs over these two people they'd killed so horribly. Strange, isn't it?
Record number 3.
I think it would be a good moment, perhaps, to have some Indian music, because it reminds me of a period when I was quite young. I was in Natal and knew a remarkable Indian family who brought the Upanishads, the sacred books of India, and above this music, which is concerned with the greatest mythological story in Indian history.
Nag Kansi Kara, played by Huri Prasad Chal Rasiya. We hear a lot these days, Sir Lawrence van der Post, about post-traumatic stress syndrome and counselling after witnessing terrible events like the ones you've just been describing, but you didn't need any of it, it seems. You stayed on, I think, in Indonesia for some time. But you did, nevertheless, some years later, go into the bush. You needed to. It was some kind of therapy for you. Can you describe to me what happens when you do that?
After about 2.5 years, when I got to Johannesburg on a cold evening, I felt I didn't want to see people. I've had enough of human beings. So the next day, I got a truck and I got supplies. I hired a gun and I took 2 black people with me and I took off into the bush. There was a certain place that came to my mind I must go to. And there I camped. And while my people were making camp, I walked out. And out of the bush stepped an enormous kudu with that lovely head of horns it has. It has most beautiful horns, a kudu, perhaps the most beautiful of any antelope. And it walked out of the bush. It was quite unafraid of me. It stood there. It looked at me and then sort of sniffed the air like that. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm coming home. But the point was, I spent 3 weeks there. And by the day, the war seemed to slip away from me. Until one day I felt, yes, I'm okay now. I can go and see people.
But that has, therefore, I think, helped you form one of what I believe to be one of your very profound beliefs, isn't it? That we, 20th century man, have lost contact with nature. You've said, I think, words to the effect, I don't think a man who's watched the sun go down could walk away and commit a murder. It's it's that thought that we all need to get back.
Yes, we need to rediscover that. I feel it more than ever. That our survival now depends upon rediscovering that in ourselves.
What is the consequence of not rediscovering that in ourselves?
Well, what's going on now? Nature is terribly under attack simply because we've become a fundamentally metropolitan civilization and we no longer know what nature is about. And I think if you ignore nature without, you also, as my experience taught me, you ignore nature within.
Record number 4.
This is music of which I think often it reflects something very ironic that happened to me in the war. I was sent to create a college for teaching guerrilla warfare when I came out of Abyssinia in Palestine. And the place in which I had to teach it was a small monastery. And this monastery was built there originally by the Crusaders, because it was the place where they maintained Christ showed himself first to his disciples after the resurrection. And there the irony of it, I was really taught basically what became in a mature form, commando tactics. It seemed to me so ironic. This is the place where I'm teaching people how to kill. And I often think back, because I went particularly to a Greek Orthodox church where they had what I call the resurrection music they play. And this reminds me of the Byzantine resurrection music of that period and brings it vividly back.
Part of the Byzantine chant, Passion and Resurrection, sung by Sister Marie Kérouse. The wilderness, the bush, as you've described, is obviously a great source of strength to you, Sir Lawrence. It's also a place of dreams and of myth and of legend, isn't it? Because isn't it the case when you went eventually in search of the Bushman, you trespassed, you broke certain taboos, and strange things happened to you as a result?
There was a particularly extraordinary thing that happened to me at some hills I discovered in the Kalahari Desert. As far as I know, no European had been to them before. And a witch doctor one day told me about these hills. And he said to me, I'll tell you how to get there because I feel it's important you go there. But you must promise me you will not go there with blood on your hands. And when I set out for these hills ultimately, with this man's son to guide me, I always travelled behind, as we'd been taught in the war, and I suddenly heard some shots in front. And I'd forgotten, I hadn't told the hunter who hunted for our food not to shoot.
So there was blood on your hands?
Yes. And so we arrived there, and from the word go, everything went wrong. The camera, after going wrong, blew up. In our camp every morning, we were attacked by bees. All sorts of things went wrong. In despair one evening, I walked away and thought, now what can I do? And I went back and I told this trainee witch doctor. I said, suppose I wrote a letter to the spirits of the hill, begging their pardon, and we go and bury it at the foot of a lovely panel, it's called the Vanderpost panel today, of ancient rock painting. And we went up early the next morning, and I'd written this letter, begging the pardon of the spirits. The dawn had just fully broken, and the whole of the Kalahari from the height was visible. It looked lovely. And I said to them, man, do you think we will be forgiven now? He said, would you like me to ask the spirits? I said, yes, do. And he went into a kind of trance and then said to me, yes, the spirit says, well, now everything will go well for you. It did go well.
Were these the theories, Sir Lawrence, and wilderness therapy and so on, and this deep respect for nature that you've talked about, and an understanding perhaps of what might happen if you didn't respect it, were these the sorts of things that you taught Prince Charles as a young man? This is what you talk to him about.
Darling, I would rather not talk about that, if you wouldn't mind.
Right. I think it's well known that you've been a great friend for many years now. What sort of king do you think he will make?
I think he'll be a great king. He's a great prince already, and he'll be a great king.
Tell me about record number 5.
This piece of music by Brendel has meant an awful lot to me. I think Brendel is, of course, an incomparable pianist. He was a particular friend also of one of my greatest friends who died much too young of cancer. He died very painfully, and the drugs had ceased to take the pain away. But Brendel had presented him with a whole range of the Beethoven sonatas. And my friend, when the pain was too much, would get the nurses to play Brendel to him. And the pain went. And when he died, at his funeral service in St. Paul's Cathedral, Brendel played this piece, and it tells us a lot about Brendel, about the power of music and the sort of things that he sums up in life for me. Thank you.
part of the second movement of Beethoven's Sonata No. 17 in D minor, played by Alfred Brendel. It's always said, Sir Lawrence, that you had a great deal of influence on Mrs. Thatcher when she was Prime Minister. You talked a lot, I think, during the Falklands War. Would you say you helped her come to terms with the moral dilemma of making war?
Nobody deplored the dilemma more than she did. But I think she dearly felt, out of a deep moral conviction, that there are moments in life when, in defence of life, life has to be, if necessary, has to be taken.
Do you still see Mrs. Thatcher?
Yes, of course, she's a friend. I see her from time to time. Not as much as I did before she went into politics, alas.
The one public person you've most famously criticised is Nelson Mandela, who on his release...
No, I haven't criticised him. I never have criticised him. Who says so?
I thought you said, when he was released after 27 years, that he was more a myth than a man, and that he was coming out with moth-eaten platitudes.
No, I've never said that. It's completely untrue. What I did say to a meeting I addressed of the press in Cape Town, I said to them, you all must have been disappointed by the speech Mr. Mandela made when he came out of prison, that instead of talking to us out of his heart and out of his vision of Africa, he presented us with a piece of moth-eaten communism. I said, now, why couldn't he, when he came out, do what Martin Luther King did in America and say, I've got a dream, and spoke to the Americans about the dream that he had of a society without racial prejudices. Why doesn't he come and talk to us about the dream? And he sent me a message to say, it is quite right, he did have a dream, but the time hadn't come to talk about it yet. What happened then? The press interpreted that as an attack on Mandela. But can you see an attack in what I said?
I think that because he'd been in jail for 27 years, that people felt that even to say you were disappointed in him was rather
harsh.
No,
I said I was disappointed in the speech.
Do you think that events now have proved that he is a man of profound integrity?
You know that one hears very disquieting things. Why is Johannesburg called the murder capital of the world? That didn't happen before. I don't know. I've not been there. I'd rather not talk.
But are you suggesting that you're pessimistic about the future for South Africa?
No, I think South Africa has broken out of apartheid. That's so important. And it's on the road again. But it's a difficult and it's a dangerous road.
Record number 6.
It's Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was one of my gang in London before the war. And for me, he had a voice which has been unequalled. It was lovely to hear him sing. And I thought of this one because the lazy bones in the song so reminds me of the black people in Africa who suddenly, working very hard, would go and sit in the sun. And people say, oh, look how lazy they are. But they were sitting in the sun all day long. They were an area of themselves between their conscious and their unconscious selves. And then the next day, they would be working as hard as ever. They've healed something in themselves. Well, lazy bones makes me think of all those things.
Lazy bones, sleeping in the sun. How you expect to get your day's work done? Never get your day's work done. Sleeping in the noonday sun. Lazy bones, sleeping in the shade. How you expect to get your cornmeal made?
Paul Robeson and Lazy Bones. What if the Bushman today, Sir Lawrence, banished once again from his land because the Botswanans want it free of humans, they want to create a national park, what is the world losing as a result of that?
Oh, I think it's losing something very, very precious. So the campaign still goes on.
But do you accept perhaps any responsibility for the beginning of the end of the Bushman, because, of course, it was you who rediscovered him, as you've described, 40 years ago, who filmed him and showed him to the world. Once that process had begun, and he saw the world and the world saw him, wasn't that always going to be the beginning of the end?
Well, he was going to be exposed to the modern world sooner or later, and my series on the lost world of the Kalahari, I did it to save him, naively, to save him.
Is there anything that can be done to save him now, really?
Well, I think leave him and let him emerge in his own way into the modern world now. They're very intelligent people, and I think he'll find his own. It's the only way. If you evict him from the desert and you put him in some settlement, he loses his life, which goes very, very deep.
Record number 7.
When I was in prison, the only sort of music one heard outside was Malay music. And there was a Malay love song, which even the Japanese guards played on gramophone records, that has stayed with me. It's a song that a girl sang to the full moon, which she sees in the water in front of her. It's called Terang Bulan. It's so good a tune that the Malays of Malaya have chosen it for their national anthem. And it is one of the comforts that one had of, yes, there is, in spite of prison, a normal feminine life going on outside, thank God.
Abikair singing the Malayan love song and now national anthem indeed, Terang Bulan, full moon. As you know, Sir Lawrence, we cast you away at this point, alone on a desert island. From everything I think you've said, I suspect you'll be entirely happy there, won't you?
It'd be wonderful on a desert island not to hear people talk, not to hear the noises, but to sit back and let the future come at one.
And you are, as we've heard, a man who's seen much death in life. Does that mean that you fear it more or less?
I always, in a sense, by what I've seen of death and dying, I'm comforted by the way it confers a great majesty on the people who die. I don't think fear comes into it. Obviously, I would hate to confront it consciously, but I think if one's blessed to have it happen naturally to one, one couldn't ask for a better welcome to the future.
And can I ask you what you personally would most like to be remembered for?
I would just like people to remember that whatever happened to me in life was good, and that I think that I've loved people on the whole and I've loved life. And I think I will die with, I hope I will die with that intact.
Last record.
My last is, to quote T.S. Eliot, is to find my end in my beginning. And I do so happily in this piece of music played for us by Yo-Yo Ma. Because Yo-Yo Ma didn't question what use are the Bushmen, what can they give life. He came to me and he said, you know, I'm so moved by them and what they are. I want to take my music to them and let them play their music to me. He went and he played to them and they played to him. And then when he came back, one day rang me up, he said he would like to come and say thank you to me. And he came to our house and he came with that famous cello of his and he said he was going to play something for us. And we opened all the windows and all the doors so that the whole building could hear it as well. And he played this lovely piece of Bach. Thank you.
The final movement of Bach's Suite No. 6 in D major, played by Yo-Yo Ma. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Sir Lawrence, I wonder which one it would be.
I think I could quite easily settle for Brendel playing the sonata.
And what about your book? You know that you've got the Bible there and the complete works of Shakespeare. They're already there.
Are they? Well, that's good.
So what one other book would you like to take?
Could I take Fraser's Golden Bough?
Indeed you could. And what about your luxury?
A piano, if I could. Because then I can start playing again. I used to play the piano, slightly. And it meant a great deal to me. But I'd love to learn to play properly. You know that Socrates, when he was preparing for his death, he felt that music had been lacking in his life and that he would like to learn to play the lute. Well, I would like, before I die, to learn to play the piano properly.
Sir Lawrence van der Post, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, dear.